Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And this is the second part of what we'll run to probably three or four episodes on the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young song Ohio, which was a protest song about the Kent State shootings in 1970, where National Guardsmen, the Ohio National Guard, gunned down four students at the Kent State University in Ohio who were protesting against the Vietnam War. And this part of the narrative, and this is drawn from Dorian Lynskey's 33 Revolutions Per Minute, which is a history of protest music. This part of the narrative is really about establishing the social, political and cultural climate of the times, and the fact that in the late 1960s, Richard Nixon was really creating the kind of the conditions for a cultural civil war during the final years of Vietnam. Because of course, what is easy to forget was that the hippie movement, and not as a term I particularly like to use, but the counterculture, in all its various guises, was dwarfed by the size of American working class and middle class conservatism with a small c, people who lived fairly conventional lifestyles, believed in the authority of the government, believed in the system, the capitalist system under which they lived, and were fairly or quite religious. And These were the people that Nixon knew he could rely upon and call upon in order to win elections. And so cultural discord and societal discord in America was all was ideal, really. And he played on this expertly, and really has set the kind of the model for what American conservatism is, all the way up to Trump. In every Republican president that followed since, which would be Reagan, the two Bushes, and Trump, there has been some sort of cultural war. And when the Democrats are in power, take for example Clinton and most recently Obama, the weaponization of the language of culture has been a huge, well, it's been the principal weapon that the right has used in order to destabilize Democrat administrations. By the way, I'm not suggesting for a moment that the Democrat administrations of Clinton or Obama have been remotely on the left. So in the administration, there was a policy called positive polarization, of actively trying to create polarization. And the key event in 1969 was the trial of the Chicago 7, the Chicago 8 as it began with, but later the dismissal of Bobby Seale as one of the defendants led for them to be reduced to 7. Okay, so the trial of the Chicago 7, of David Derringer, Tom Hayden, Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Rennie Davis, Lee Wiener, John Froines, and of course Bobby Seale, but he was absented in the end, began on the 24th of September, and the charge was conspiracy to riot. The reason why the charges had been brought was because there was a riot outside the Democratic National Convention in 1968, as the Democratic Party chose its new candidate, and the anti-war activists of the SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, and the Youth International Party, the Yippies, which was led by Hoffman and Rubin, created the circumstances, though it was largely down to the police, in reality, for a riot to take place. The trial, writes Dorian Linsky, began on September the 24th. Rubin and Hoffman hoped to put the system itself on trial and pump their message into millions of American homes. The prosecution planned to retrospectively tie disparate, even competing personalities into one big sinister plot. Each camp was selling an illusion to the viewing public, exaggerating its opponent's villainy in a kind of media arms race. Abby Hoffman demonstrated with his flair for phrase-making, dubbing the courtroom a neon oven, insisting he was a citizen of the Woodstock Nation, and claiming, rather optimistically, that rock musicians are the real leaders of the revolution. The defence called a string of counterculture stars, including Allen Ginsberg, Timothy Leary, Norman Mailer, Arlo Guthrie, Phil Ox, and Country Joe McDonald, who began fixing to die. "No, no, no, Mr. Witness," interrupted Judge Julius Hoffman. "No singing." McDonald recited the lyrics instead. If the prevailing mood was one of puckish disrespect, then a darker note was sounded by self-styled revolutionary Linda Hager Morse. "After Chicago, I changed from being a pacifist to the realisation that we had to defend ourselves," she said, speaking for many of her peers. "A non-violent revolution was impossible. I desperately wish it was possible." One of the problems of the left in the 1960s is that it was fragmented, and you had small parties like the SDS fragmenting to even smaller parties One of the most infamous of those being the Jesse James gang, and they fragmenting even into even smaller parties. And one of the offshoots of the Jesse James gang was a group called Weatherman or the Weather Underground. And the reason for choosing the name is that it was derived from Bob Dylan's song "Subterranean Homesick Blues," where the line says, "You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows," and the Weather Underground were one of the few groups in America during the 1960s to actually resort to acts of terrorism. They did send out bombs, and I don't believe they managed to kill anybody, but that's kind of not the point. So during the trial of the Chicago 7, the Weather Underground staged its own media event called the Days of Rage. The intention was for a second Battle of Chicago, writes Dorian Lynskey. "Bring the war home," urged posters and leaflets, although the hopeful hordes of working class revolutionaries never materialized, and plans for a wargasm rock festival came to nothing. A few hundred demonstrators embarked on 2 days of street fighting, during which the lawyer Richard Elrod, who pushed for the Chicago 8 indictments, tried to leap on a weatherman, missed and crashed into a wall and was paralyzed for life. That night, Hayden was racked by anxiety. Between Judge Hoffman's courtroom and the weathermen, he asked himself, where was the sanity? Most left-wing commentators regarded the Days of Rage as a feeble, irresponsible fiasco. Hendrik Hertzberg of the anti-war magazine WIN called it a huge unearned windfall for the forces of repression. Chicago Black Panther Fred Hampton, whom Weatherman considered an ally, denounced the group as anarchistic, opportunistic, adventuristic, and custeristic. At Weatherman's December War Council in Flint, Michigan, they sang vicious parodies from the Weatherman songbook, including White Christmas, I'm Dreaming of a White Riot, just like the one on October 8th, and Dylan's Lay Lady Lay, Stay Elrod Stay, Stay in Your Iron Lung. Over subsequent months, they went underground, cutting ties with their families and assuming fake names in preparation for further action. And I think the point that Fred Hampton makes here is the kind of the salient one, in that not all kind of action by the revolutionary left was actually welcomed by the rest of the revolutionary left, or seen as helpful or warranted or useful. And it gave the Nixon administration a perfect opportunity to appeal directly to this group that this demographic that the administration, the Nixon administration, called the silent majority of middle Americans who were becoming highly dissatisfied and resentful towards the radical social changes of the 60s. And if they could point to troublemakers and malcontents and dangerous types, then they would embrace the kind of social and cultural conservatism that Nixon offered. This, combined with the Southern strategy, which is a kind of a different conversation altogether, were the kind of the roots of Nixon's electoral success in 1972. The idea of armed revolution went mainstream in 1969. Short-lived WHO affiliates Thunderclap Newman cried, "Hand out the arms and ammo" on Something in the Air, while Jefferson Airplane whooped, got a revolution? Got to revolution," on Volunteers. Columbia Records cynically branded their early 1969 rock releases revolutionaries with the slogan, "The man can't bust our music." And even hardware company Vaco jumped on the bandwagon, calling, "Join the Tool Revolution." As critic Robert Christgau shrewdly noted, it took about 18 months from 1967 to late 1969 for the idea of revolution to evolve from an illusion of humorless politicnics to a hip password. You only need to look at movies like Network, the Sidney Lumet movie.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Where a tired and demoralized broadcaster who claims to be speaking the truth for the first time in his life is co-opted by a network that suddenly finds it immensely popular. I think Network is set in the late 1970s, but how the ideas of the counterculture are very quickly corporatized and packaged and resold back to a restless and angry audience. It's a brilliant movie, by the way, if you haven't seen it, to show how this conception of revolution suddenly became very, very tame, very, very easy to kind of co-opt and sell. There are all sorts of fascinating moments in the Marvel comics of the late 1960s, where obviously Stan Lee and Steve Ditko and other of the kind of the original Marvel crew could see which way the wind was blowing, and created all these sort of created particularly the character of Black Panther characters that they thought would capture an audience. In this roiling year, writes Dorian Lynskey, every major event seemed to invite two opposing perspectives. Take Woodstock. The national media, in the same brief, Aquarian Frenzy, which led Hollywood to produce such calamitous LSD farces as Candy and Skidoo, went gaga for the history's biggest happening. A swooning Time report approvingly quoted Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and declared, "In its energy, its lyrics, its advocacy of frustrated joys, rock is one long symphony of protest. Although many adults generally find it hard to believe, the revolution it preaches, implicitly or explicitly, is basically moral." Some of its readers were not so sure. "Congratulations," wrote Mrs. A. Anderson Huber from Atlanta. "Your article does a superb job of furthering the moral decay of this nation." But it was people like that who would, that attitude, that sentiment, which would win out in the late 60s and the early 1970s. By the mid-1970s, with the end of the Vietnam War, the student protest movement really begins to kind of crumble, and particularly with the end of the draft, it goes into steep decline, and the sense of fighting to reclaim the nation from moral turpitude and was a huge kind of consolidating and motivating factor on the political right that managed to help guide counter-revolutionary or anti-progressive movements from the mid-1960s onwards. A particular example being the galvanisation against the Equal Rights Amendment led by the conservative Phyllis Schlafly. Anyway, those amongst the silent majority who saw Woodstock as a muddy Sodom and Gomorrah found their very own anthem the following month in Merle Haggard's country music hit, Okie from Muskogee. Although Haggard would later call it a satirical look at middle America, bemused by weed-smoking, free-living hippies, and it is a pretty funny song, millions of listeners embraced it without irony. The Okie, when celebrated by Woody Guthrie as a proletarian hero for the left, was now a resentful patriot who waved old glory and believed in living in right and being free. A subsequent live version was punctuated by an entirely unsatirical cry of Tell It Like It Is from a crowd member, and the follow-up single left no room for humour. In The Fight Inside of Me, Haggard delivered a surly warning to squirrely griping peaceniks who were running down my country. Like Okie from Muskogee, it topped the country singles chart for weeks. And the success of the conservative right in the next couple of decades was based on understanding who Merle Haggard was speaking to. Instead of a working class that saw itself as being the victims of economic elites who expropriated wealth from them, Merle Haggard the people that bought Merle Haggard's records believed that they were victims of a bourgeoisie, a left liberal bourgeoisie that didn't know it was born. Arrogant, out of touch, unpatriotic, and stuck in academic ivory towers, they were content to run down the country and tell other Americans that America was bad and racist and imperialist and all these other isms. And to undermine the efforts of America's fighting men abroad, combined with an aesthetic, a physical look of, you know, men with long hair and beads and things like that, who were smoking cannabis and taking drugs and listening to Jimi Hendrix, and advocating lifestyles which were fairly alien to lots of middle America. These were the people that Nixon could speak to. And again, the relationship between the elite political class and the American working and middle class has really been expertly captured by the political right. There's a reason why people like Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush adopted this kind of persona of the kind of the rootsy, folksy, down at home guy who don't speak fancy highfalutin talk. No, he's the sort of person who isn't going to belittle you. It's immensely popular. It is immensely popular, and it works. And the idea that a rejection of academia, a rejection of the student movement, a rejection of the kind of the East and West Coast liberal intelligentsia was the key to winning election after election. This is something, again, the political right have understood implicitly and still understand today. And in a way, there is the seeds from in the late 1960s and 70s of weaponizing this kind of anti-intellectualism that you see in a much more exaggerated form in the 2000s and leading up to the Trump era, where and it has been part of the playbook of Fox News, particularly since the 1990s, of those snobs are laughing at you, or those unpatriotic liberal know-nothings who think they're so terrifically clever are running the country down. This is kind of like the narrative, the political narrative of how conservatism works. And if you look at who was around in the Nixon era, many of them, the likes of Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, made it through. You know, Rumsfeld died only a few weeks ago. Their afterlife from Nixon onwards shaped the Reagan years, shaped the Bush years. And if it weren't for the fact that Trump is a rank political outsider, would have shaped Trump as well. But Trump has Roy Cohn, who has a heritage all the way back to kind of McCarthyism, and Roger Stone, who was one of the malign influences around the Watergate scandal to help him to further a very similar agenda. So it's really, really fascinating to look at how the cultural struggles of the 1960s are still with us and still being played out. Dorian Ninsky writes, "In the final weeks of 1969, it was as if the worst fears of both sides had become flesh. Middle America came face to face with 35-year-old Charles Manson, the nightmare hippie whose crazed followers, drawn from the human flotsam of Haight Ashbury, had hacked to death actress Sharon Tate and three of her friends in August. But Weatherman's Bernardine Dorn called the killings wild. The anti-war movement learned about Lieutenant William Kelly, a man with bland good looks of a high school jock, who'd allegedly overseen the massacre of 109 civilians in the Vietnamese hamlet of My Lai, following the Tet Offensive. But in one poll, following the publication of reporter Seymour Hersh's revelations, 49% of Minnesotans refused to believe it had happened at all. Two crimes, two emblematic villains, two Americas." And I guess if there is, there isn't a clearly observable parallel with our times of the refusal to believe objective truth, we're not looking hard enough. Anyway, thanks very much for listening tonight, folks. You can check out the Explaining History podcast at www.explaininghistory.org. If you can back the Patreon there, that's always helpful, helps to keep the podcast going. And you can check us out on YouTube too. Thanks very much, everybody. All the best. Take care. Bye-bye.
On a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.